WW Perspectives. In 2015, two fellows from Woodrow Wilson programs won Pulitzer Prizes for their work. Today, we're talking with one of them, 1998 Newcomb Fellow Elizabeth Fenn, who goes by Lil. Dr. Fenn is the Walter and Lucian Driscoll Professor and Chair of the History Department at the University of Colorado Boulder, and she won the Pulitzer Prize in History for her most recent book, Encounters at the Heart of the World, A History of the Mandan People. Lil, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So, looking back at the records from 1998, I saw that your dissertation title pointed to your first book. You worked as a 98 Newcomb Fellow on a project that turned into Pax Americana, which has been characterized as a study of smallpox as germ warfare during the American Revolution. Tell me a little bit about that work and whether or not it has a connection to Encounters at the Heart of the World, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book.
Well, it absolutely has a connection, but to back up, that book was a study of a continent-wide smallpox epidemic that swept all of North America in the years from 1775 to 1782, which many people will recognize as almost exactly the years of the American Revolution. So it affected warfare on the East Coast, but it also hit Mexico City. I mean, the truth is it was a hemispheric epidemic. It swept into South America. It migrated northward along the Camino Real in Mexico to Spanish colonies in what we now know of as the United States, spread across the Great Plains, and ended up eventually burning itself out on the coast of Southeast Alaska. Now, in the process of doing that research, I came across the Mandan people. Like many others, I had heard of the Mandans by virtue of Lewis and Clark. Lewis and Clark spent their first winter on their transcontinental trek among the Mandans. That was the winter of 1804-1805. But I didn't know much about the Mandans beyond that. So when I encountered them working on Pax Americana, I was honestly floored by the size of the population, by the quality and quantity of the commerce that flowed through their villages, and by the overall significance of this major, sort of semi-urban population hub on the northern plains during the period of the American Revolution. And I wondered why we didn't know that history. So that's what carried me to the Mandans.
Terrific. Maybe this is a side note, and maybe it's not. There seems to have been debate over the years, and a fairly politicized debate at that, about the intentionality of the spread of smallpox among different Native American populations. And certainly there are moments in Encounters at the Heart of the World where it seems possible to the reader that Europeans and Americans, if not entirely intentional about bringing contagion among the Native people, weren't terribly careful. Is there anything that you would want to say about that whole set of issues and what you found in your research?
Sure. I did research some years ago, sort of as a sideline to Pax Americana, on this question of what we would now call biological warfare in the colonial and revolutionary and later periods, too. What I found was that we have damning evidence, convincing, irrefutable evidence for at least one incident of intentional infection of Native peoples. That took place in 1763 at Fort Pitt, Pittsburgh today, in western Pennsylvania. The incident occurred during Pontiac's Rebellion in 1763, and British officials and traders at Fort Pitt gave Native peoples blankets taken from the smallpox hospital with the intention of spreading the disease among them. We have correspondence between Sir Geoffrey Amherst and his subordinates at Fort Pitt. Amherst makes it clear he supports this plan. And we also have eyewitness testimony of a fur trader on the scene who writes, he says, we gave something to the, this isn't a direct quote, but something to the effect of, we gave the Indians blankets from the smallpox hospital. We hope it will have the desired effect. So we have, you know, very damning evidence for that incident. Later on, Thomas Gage signed off on paying the expenses for using the blankets. So, you know, it's clear that many British officials approved of it. Now, as for the Mandans and the smallpox that afflicted them on multiple occasions, we don't have any evidence that it was deliberate. I know some people have said it was deliberate. I just have not seen any evidence suggesting it was deliberate. Having said that, it's nevertheless clear to me that what occurred, especially in 1837, 1838, was willful neglect of truly horrific proportions. The smallpox epidemic of 1837-38 was initiated by the arrival of a steamboat named St. Peter. People knew, the captain knew, other people knew that smallpox had been aboard the boat, even if people on the boat were in the healing stages by this time. And people also understood how smallpox spread. They nevertheless took no measures to keep smallpox from spreading from the boat to the Mandan people at Metahunkush, or other places, I should say, where they stopped on their journey up and down the Missouri River. And, you know, they could have acted differently. So I would call this really willful neglect of horrific proportions.
It's such a painful history. And, you know, you said earlier something that I think comes across in the book and resonates with the reader. It's astonishing that there should be a people so numerous and so accomplished about whom we've heard so little. In fact, Encounters is really a kind of majestic, moving portrait of an incredibly accomplished people with terrible misfortunes and terrible things done to them. One of the saddest moments is near the end of Chapter 3, where there's an official at one of the forts who's reporting that these extremely accomplished agriculturalists didn't look likely ever to be prosperous farmers. How have we lost sight of these people who were so numerous and skilled and influential?
Well, I think early American historians have been remiss probably in three ways. You know, first of all, we tend to neglect native peoples, you know, and instead start our stories with the arrival of Europeans and Africans. Secondly, we tend to neglect the middle of the continent, you know, and the West. You know, early American history traditionally has been the story, again, of the arrival of Europeans and Africans on the Atlantic seaboard and their incremental march westward. Now, scholarship has changed in recent years, and we're making some vast improvements in that regard. But the third way we've been neglectful is that we have neglected, we've ignored thousands of years of history, and this is, I will call it, this is American history that preceded European contact. You know, just because Europeans weren't here doesn't mean there's not a history, that it doesn't matter, and that it doesn't shape what unfolds later. So most of American history, I would argue, is Native American history, and it extends back thousands upon thousands of years, and it's amazingly rich, you know, interesting story.
Now that leads me into a question about the making of Encounters. If you're going to go back thousands of years, you know, working with cultures that were primarily, you know, oral cultures, obviously it's necessary to engage a variety of disciplines, not just history. That work certainly shows in the book. And I gather that the evidence that you were working with was often fragmentary or hard to come by. What were some of the challenges for you as an historian in pulling this project together, and how did you tackle them?
Well, the evidence is indeed fragmentary, and there are many discontinuities in it. For me, though, that's the joy of doing history, is trying to bridge the gaps, using my imagination, asking myself, you know, how can I solve this problem? What other sources might be useful? As a consequence, in this book, I ended up using sources ranging from geology to epidemiology to nutritional science. I used early, you know, 20th century ethnographies, you know, sacred stories, archaeology, and I used the more conventional written record. In order to pull this off, I ended up doing using a literary strategy that was somewhat unusual. I wrote the book in a series of sort of datelined entries, most of which are quite brief. Probably the longest is maybe 5 pages long. My hope is that this format kind of acknowledges the fragmentary qualities of the evidence, but nevertheless, you know, hangs together to create a compelling narrative about this amazing place on the Upper Missouri River in North Dakota. I like to tell people now, they ask me what I work on, I tell them I work on late medieval and early modern North Dakota. And I often get some strange looks.
It really is a compelling narrative, and your place in it. I mean, you tread very lightly as a narrator. You're clearly a historian first, and yet there are the moments where you show us your contact with the Mandan community, and you make it clear that that's another key part of your ability to tell their story, a kind of personal relationship that you developed. What would you say about how your personal relationship with the Mandan community today complemented your scholarship? What has it meant to you? And maybe most importantly, how does the Mandan community feel about the result of your work with them?
Well, I've heard nothing but positive responses from the Mandans. And the Mandans now are part of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara, or Sanish Nation, the three affiliated tribes, and they've been immensely supportive. I have to give all credit to Mandan people. My friend Cedric Redfeather, who was a Mandan turtle priest, Nuweta Wakikina, actually reached out to me, and he changed the book dramatically by doing so. I had a manuscript some years ago that pretty much ignored Mandan spiritual life, mostly because I didn't feel competent or able to deal with it. And Cedric called me out on it. He didn't call me out on it, you know, abruptly or intrusively or aggressively, but in a very gentle way, he just kept reminding me how important it was to acknowledge the spiritual dimensions of Mandan life. And that's actually what led me to write in the first person on occasion in this book, because I wanted readers to be aware of my own uncertainties, my own, you know, ambivalence about doing this, given that I see the world so differently and that I experience the world so differently. You know, writing a book like this is to some extent an act of hubris, and I felt like I had to acknowledge that, and I wanted to bring the readers along for that, to let them know, you know, what a sloppy process scholarship really is. You know, and I think we need to be frank about that. We write with such authority sometimes that I think readers come away with a false sense of what we're engaged in.
Well, the process may be sloppy, but the book is absolutely gripping and fluid and wonderful and brings it all together beautifully. So congratulations on the amply deserved Pulitzer. It's a pleasure to read. I wonder if I could just change gears for a moment and ask, you know, back in 98, I've read a little bit about your grad school career and wonder, you know, kind of what did the Newcomb Fellowship mean to you as someone finishing a dissertation in 1998? And do you think a fellowship like the Newcomb is still important for people who are doing their PhD work today?
The Newcomb was immensely important to me because it gave me what all scholars need most, at least all scholars in the humanities, which is time to write. And had I not received the Newcomb, I would have ended up, you know, scrambling around and working as I was writing, and the dissertation would have probably taken longer, and it certainly would not have been as polished. I was able to take Pax Americana and publish it within basically 2 years, 2.5 years of receiving my PhD. And it was, you know, it was a Newcomb that, you know, enabled all that. Given the current zeitgeist of the arts and the humanities today, I think it's more important than ever to have these sorts of fellowships available. And we need more of them, quite honest.
Oh.
We really do.
Any preview of what you're working on next that we can look forward to?
Well, I am working on, or not working on, in the aftermath of this prize, it has been extremely hard for me to get any of my own work done. But my aspiration is to craft a biography of Sacagawea. What I'd like this to be is a biography of Sacagawea that really is sort of an exercise in bait and switch. My vision is to use Sacagawea to convey a much bigger history of the American West. So Sacagawea, this probably the most famous woman in American history, she and Pocahontas, ironically both Native women, but, you know, use Sacagawea's life story to connect to these other bigger transitions and questions in the history of the American West.
Lil, that sounds terrific and definitely something to look forward to. I hope that you get the time and focus to work on it, although I can't wish that the Pulitzer Prize Führer would die down anytime soon because it's amply deserved. So thank you for taking the time.
Well, sure. Thank you. It's been really a fun chat.